let's get going. A few things, in case somebody told me about this and said they would like if I presented that in class. So is anybody part of the group that they could mention anything about it? The Apollo Society? No? Is anybody a member? No? Well, anyways, they're getting together. It's pre-Allied Health, all the Allied Health, dentistry, PT, PA, all that, and they're having a get-together, a social, and I guess the catching point is free food, so at least you can go get your free food. And then maybe hear about the different programs that they have to offer, okay? So 5 p.m., February the 27th, Lewis College, all right, good deal. And also, has anybody ever been to E-Day before, Engineering Day on campus? How'd you like it? And you've been there too?
No? Yeah, I volunteered.
Oh, isn't that great? And they get free popcorn, don't you? Yes, another good thing. So this weekend is Engineering Day on campus. And I think it starts around 8 or 9 or so. But it's over in the engineering quadrant. And it is super, really. I mean, you go through all the buildings. They have mechanical, civil, electrical, chemical engineering, ag engineering. And you just look at the activities that they have. And they go all out. I mean, there's like asphalt energy, and there's even companies that are recruiting people. Biomedical engineering, hint, hint, you know, bio, right? Biomedical engineering. So it's a really good program to kind of see, and they have some really neat aspects, like how to grow grass and, you know, with zero gravity, and they have these things that rotate around, and oh, so many neat things. But just going there and looking at all the different displays, it just keeps your mind really going and seeing the possibilities. But the bioengineering group is really quite interesting, too, like prosthetic limbs and things like that. I don't know what they have this year, but it's always kind of a fun thing to do. And then there's things in the basement of the engineering quadrant. If you don't know, there's a whole basement complex down there underneath the engineering buildings, and they have like robotics that they're testing, and then also like bridge building and collapsing, and they have competitions and all that kind of good stuff. But it's really fun to do on the weekend, Saturday. Yes, engineering quadrant. The parking will be a nightmare, but you know, you can park pretty much in the free in the clinic or over there on Rose Street on the weekend. Okay, if you didn't pick up your exams, like Shane, Taylor, and Madeline, those are here. Quizzes on your second quiz and your score sheets for the exam that we had for mostly in the lab that was on Monday because I didn't have those back from the university. But if you need those, check out after class, and we'll get those to you. There's this other assignment which we're going to put up. I'll try to put that up tonight and maybe change the due date. But this lecture assignment, I'll give you a PDF, and I'll send it to you through Canvas as well. It's not real hard. It's going to be easy. But to get you kind of motivated and pick a topic that you like now that we're far enough along in the class, or you can wait a little bit too, and we'll probably move the due date down a little bit. But the assignment will be to pick a topic in physiology of your interest and write a short, less than 500 words, description of that topic in layman's terms, like if you're writing it for Science Daily, right? No real specific, you know, detailed words that only the scientist in that area is going to understand, but how would you explain something from a primary article, right, in the last 2 years or so, or something of really interest to you that you found an article to, so you can give that link, and I'll put up the whole assignment, that you write for a general layman's audience to try to explain that scientific finding. Okay? So that'll be the general idea, and I'll send you more details on it. But if you have something in mind, start percolating that. It's supposed to be a fun activity, but not a waste of time, because what you'll realize, it's kind of hard to write it something scientifically in layman's terms that the general public could understand without using terminology that will be confusing, right? Or explain it out if you have to define something. But it's the more that we can explain science to the general public that aren't scientifically literate, the better off society will be, because then they'll understand why they're spending their tax dollars in scientific research, right? And that's pretty important these days. Okay, so we're cruising through. Hopefully today we will get through the sensory chapter, and I know it is fast and furious, right? And so I do understand that. And a lot of little, you know, little pieces coming together. But try to get the main point out of each topic that we're covering. remember, every one of these topics that we cover could be a whole course. I mean, there's a whole course on the retina. There's a whole course like on the inner ear that you can take, you know, and so understanding those concepts. You know, a whole course just on cardiovascular, you know, work. So we really are just kind of surveying the top of it. But to highlight some main points. So that's where we are. And I know you can get lost easily in the forest, so I don't want you to get too lost, but the main topics. So we're on the inner ear, the mammalian inner ear primarily, but other animals as well have similar structures that we're going to talk about and understand. So let's just kind of recap a little bit. What's the utriculus and sacculus? What does that do for us? Utriculus and sacculus. Just kind of think. When you hear that, think about little stones sitting on a mucous membrane and hair cells underneath. And that little stone is what? Sensing gravity, right? So when you bend your head that way, you know your head's that way. When you bend forward, you know your head's forward, right? And that then gives you static position of your head, right? So that's kind of neat. And then what are the semicircular canals doing? They tell you when you're moving your head around, like angular velocity too, but when you're moving it forward or backwards, so that movement, right? And it's amazing how well you can you can close your eyes and you can move your head around and you can really tell exactly where your head is, right? So that's pretty neat. And you've probably all been on one of those things in the children's ground when you're in elementary school and they spin you around and around, right? And you get off and you can't walk. It's because that fluid's still moving, right? And it needs to kind of settle down before you can get your balance back. And some people get quite dizzy by that. But that's really interesting because, as we mentioned before, just to recap, you can set up convection currents in your ear by giving warm water or cold water to one ear, and you will see a stereotypic type of behavior in a person with normal function, right? Because you can set up a convection current just by heating that up. But also that could be a problem for people. Some people are very sensitive with that cold in the ear. For example, even on a cold day or moisture gets in there, and it can cause somebody to lose their balance. Let's say you're riding your bike in cold rain on a cold day, and you get all that cold in there, and then all of a sudden you don't really know where you are, and your balance is off, right? You can have an accident for these kind of things. All right, so these are things to think about that can really be quite interesting in your normal day of life as well. And remember that little ampulla that's right there, this little structure. If you look at that carefully down here in the bottom, you see this. And those tiny little blue cells right there, those are single cells, right, with a kinocilium and stereocilia next to it. And there's little bridges that hold them together. And if it bends one direction or the other direction, it can excite the cell or inhibit the cell. And that is a single cell with these little fingers that protrude out. And that's really amazing because that fluid that's in there can move that around, and it detects that movement of that fluid. But also that same structure, the take home here is that same structure you see in the lateral line of the fish, right? And so that's pretty neat too. It's the same kind of hair cell, the same structure that's there. And that utriculus and sacculus with that stone that's on top of that little mucous mass that those cells are sitting underneath, that's similar to the statocyst that you see in your crustacean preparations at the base of the antenna. It's the same type of principle and the same kind of anatomy, and it detects the same type of sensory systems like gravity in that sense. So pretty neat that you see these over and over again. And then we get into that cochlea for hearing, and we got into that a little bit. It's really quite interesting, the snail-like structure and how this is functioning. I mean, this inner ear is so complex, it's amazing. And you think of all the nerves that come out of there and hundreds of neurons involved. All right, so if we've talked about that already, the equilibrium, the statocyst, and then we talked about using visual sense to override, say, understanding where proprioception is. And we did in the lab, remember the proprioception that we did in the lab, right, with the vibration, the Pinocchio nose, vibrating the muscle spindles, right, and that then gives you the proprioception of knowing where your limbs are. So muscle spindles was the take-home on that. Okay, then we got into understanding hearing. So I'm just kind of going over that. Remember, we've talked about the general vibration and sound, like why you can hear me right now, and that tympanic membrane, mechanically moving three bones, malleus incestapes, pushing on this oval window, which then sets up the fluid movement. So now we went from air movement to bone to membrane to bone movement, and that bone movement now to a fluid movement. Isn't that amazing? Air, mechanical, then fluid. And that fluid movement then causes this wave to be transferred throughout this snail-like structure. And what that does is moves this membrane on the inside back and forth. And there's different fluids in these areas. So we have the perilymph. That's this green that goes around the perilymph. And then we have the endolymph. That's this blue that goes right around these sensory cells. Okay, so when that vibration's traveling down this tube, that's setting up that fluid movement, and it's pushing up and down on this membrane. And then in this part in here, the scala media, or the cochlear duct, they call it, this region in here, there's this little tectorial membrane, they call it, and it sits on top of those hair cells that we've talked about. And so it can move it one direction or move it back the other way. It's like your elbow's on a hinge, and it's, so it's going back and forth, right? So now we got that mechanical movement from that fluid movement moving that membrane, and now we're back to mechanical movement on those hairs. And those hairs bending one direction or the other direction either excites the cell or inhibits the cell. There is a really neat researcher over in the physiology department, Gregory Firkoff. Anybody work in his lab or know him? He is fantastic. Sometimes I had him come in here and give the talk about his research. So he actually works on those hair cells, and it's really neat. They actually have, and it was completely unknown, but a group at NIH where he worked with discovered that those hair cells have a little vibration, and they're moving all the time, just on their own. It's really wild. And just to kind of give you an idea, and I won't test you on this thing, but there's like calcium that comes in, and it causes the cell to move, because there's myosin on the inside of the cell, and it actually causes the cell to move. It is so bizarre. It's really interesting. But that vibration is related to its activity, too. So I won't. You don't have to know the details on that, but it's just that it's so neat. So he actually does electrophysiology on those cells and puts intracellular electrodes and measures the calcium dynamics and how it regulates the calcium signal, because they found out defects in people's hearing can relate to some of the defects in how those cells function. And so that's really neat. And then you have this hair cell that's just interesting, right? It's got the kinesome, stereosome, like your fingers off your hand. And then it's just a base right there. And it doesn't have an axon and go over here somewhere. It's just this base. But inside that base, there are vesicles in there. So it's like a sense, it's like a nerve terminal. And so calcium can come in and cause those vesicles to fuse and release transmitter. What's really bizarre is there's actually nerves that innervate onto the hair cell, and they don't completely understand what's going on there. Why are there nerves innervating onto the hair cell? And when they stimulate this, it can cause a change in how that hair cell functions. And these are still unknowns. And you'd think, we should understand hearing by now, right? And really know all about it. But that's still an area that's being researched. And these efferent innervation is still kind of a mystery exactly what it's doing. So there's lots of interesting aspects. Why people use those hair cells, they take it as a model. They'll take it out of turtles, for example, because the turtle hair cell is really large. And they can put that into a culture dish and actually work with it. But those vesicles are actually quite large, and it's a very high output type of synapse. But think about it. When you're hearing, those cells are really active, right? Those are going to be active and releasing transmitter all the time. So what about the activity dependence in that process and those vesicles recycling and refilling? So it's used as a model to try to understand some of those processes of vesicular recycling, repackaging, and at a very high rate. So it's really kind of interesting. There's a lot more to these little hair cells, but just to understand some general ideas that this is how they activate for your hearing. And if we look a little bit more about the anatomy, it's really quite amazing. So that vibration set up in here goes around, and there's differences on how that tectorial membrane, and you see these little bridges right here? These are the little hairs that are, you know, detecting that tectorial membrane movement, and they go all the way around. And it's really quite amazing. So there's a really neat arrangement of these. And people have built computational models to try to understand these. So these are actually people with computer programming skills that have reconstructed how these the tectorial membrane activates these and the whole dynamics. You get three rows of these hairs right here and then one row on the inner row. And it's really odd. Why is it so structured like this? And how is it, why is it this way? What would happen if these weren't there or those weren't there, for example? And if we, let's go to this. Well, and I just put, as we mentioned, I copied from their PowerPoints, but there's a lot of extra information on the PowerPoints for you to kind of go through and understand some of it. If you don't have the textbook, then it can kind of help you look through these. But here are 15,000 hair cells arranged in these parallel rows, like we mentioned, three inner ones and one on the other side. That's a large number of neurons in there, so think of the energy demand for hearing as well. So here it is, the perilymph going around. And then we already mentioned that you really need the round window over here to dissipate that wave, right? So you can have a better vibration. If it was a solid structure at the other end, it wouldn't work very well. What happens if when you have kind of a cold and you're stuffed up and you can't hear? Remember, you're like your ear doesn't work well. And maybe your eustachian tube, which goes to your mouth, is plugged up. Maybe some people had an infection before, a mouth infection or a throat infection, and that gets plugged up and you can't hear well, right? And you might be, pushing on your ear, right? Or if you take an airplane trip and your ears pop, right? Or you're driving up on a high mountain and that pressure difference. So you just have to open your, mouth or chewing gum, right? And it pops ears. Anybody ever travel with little kids? Or a mother that doesn't know better on an airplane and the little kid's crying when you take off and you're landing? Pass them some chewing gum and let the kid, chew on the chewing gum and it'll help pop their ears. But you can just watch the little kids that start to cry as the plane goes up because their inner ears are having some pressure differences. So some really interesting aspects there. But this perilymph and endolymph, it is just wild. I mean, how that fluid is made and controls activity. So we mentioned mostly, right, that potassium is high inside cells, right? And potassium goes out of the cell. But here's the exception. And people have just spent so much energy and resources to try to understand this. This is really quite neat. The perilymph is kind of like normal fluid. But the endolymph is something else. It's just the reverse of everything that we've been telling you about potassium moving from inside to outside. The perilymph, the endolymph, is very high in potassium. Like 100, it depends on the animal, but in the range of like 150 millimolar on the outside. And then potassium goes into the cell to depolarize it. So it's acting like sodium in that case, right? Like you normally have thought with the squid axon, where sodium goes in and depolarizes it. In this case, potassium's so high on the outside, when it goes in, it depolarizes the cell. And it's really interesting because then you wonder, wow, if that's the case, what's the sodium-potassium pump doing? Is it reversed? Right? How does it balance this? How does it get back? I mean, if it was the other way, then it would be, maybe that makes sense. So people are still researching this topic because it's so interesting that not only does this happen in these hair cells, but also a number of hair cells in invertebrates. The hair cell, like on an insect, for example, it will have a shaft, the sensory neuron, and then it has a structure around it, like the hair, right? And it's got this layer in there around that to protect that neuron, sensory ending, and then that structure like cuticle. But it's actually high in potassium, too. And potassium goes in when to activate that neuron, that sensory neuron. So it seems like it is kind of an interesting aspect with mechanosensory structures that potassium goes in. But you also see that in some insect hairs as well that detect this mechanosensory. And here we have it in the endolymph with these type of hair cells, called hair cells. Very interesting structure. So that's really cool. And then that can depolarize that cell. And so this figure sometimes is confusing because it looks like this nerve comes out of the hair cell, but really, as I mentioned, this is the base, and then this is the second order neuron that comes out of there. Okay, so let's stop this for a second. Let's go to something I pulled up online, and to try to get an idea of this. This you can go to Wikipedia and you can look up this stuff. It's so cool. But if you want to do a little bit more about it, it tells you about the endolymph and perilymph and this high potassium that's inside the endolymph, this perilymph on the sides, and the high potassium. It gives you some, you know, anatomy here. And then it tells you about the composition of the fluids. But here's something really interesting. The endolymph has a high positive potential of 80 to 120 millivolts. Wow, it's some of the largest potential in the body across any cell membrane. About the largest potential difference across any cell in the body. And that's really amazing. That's why people are trying to study this too, to understand what is going on with the cell. Really quite neat. So there's some really neat information here. And then if we look at some papers where people are actually trying to understand this, you can see that this isn't too old. What year was this? 2011, okay, so 8 years or so. But people are still trying to investigate how these cells work and how is this high potassium outside being maintained. So here they're actually interested in the sodium-potassium pump and understanding how it works in this whole aspect with endolymph, right? And if you kind of scroll down in these articles, maybe somebody wants to use something like this for their Science Daily. They've done a lot of anatomy. This one, I think, was in pigs. Wasn't this in pigs? I think they used fetal pigs or small pigs for this because they can actually get the inner ear out and actually break off the, because it's inside bone, right? And so they want real hard bone. They can get that whole inner ear out and then actually do research on it. So they look for the best animal models to do this, like August Croak principle, right? Coming back again. Let me scroll down to this idea. They did nice staining of the anatomy and all that good stuff. And then they get down to this model, which is kind of neat. Let's see if we can get rid of this. How does that thing function? Yeah. And so this is kind of neat. There's two different models they're working with. And so it's a little confusing at first, maybe. But A model and then B model, so you draw a line through here. Just the different models to try to understand, because they've realized in development, it changes to get this set up. And so it's different in as you're developing from a fetus up to a baby and then up to your adult. But the idea is that these cells, there's different types of cells, and here's a sodium-potassium pump that from the perilymph can pump potassium into the cell and sodium out like you normally think about. But then there's these potassium channels that can actually then allow potassium to go to the endolymph. And then some other cells that will actually function with different types of channels, some ATP dependent, but taking potassium in to the cell and other channels that take potassium out. The take home here is this is still kind of a black box in understanding all the details. And there's models out there, but people are testing this with, like what we said, turtle cells, and they're blocking this and finding out the potassium doesn't build up in the endolymph. And so they know that this pump isn't really important. And now they're trying to use knockdowns in different animals, particularly like insects, and knocking out these particular proteins from being expressed and try to understand how this endolymph is building up with potassium and how the whole dynamics works. Just kind of interesting to get you motivated about science and research that's still going on. And I know what's going on in your mind. Is that going to be tested, right? And how is that? And it's so confusing. Don't worry about that. It's just the idea of high potassium in the endolymph and that causes depolarization of these cells. It's kind of a unique system, but it's not just in our ear, but it's in other types of mechanosensory processes as well, like insects. Okay? To get you going. Okay. So if you look at that that membrane that we talked about, the tectorial membrane, it's kind of interesting because if you stretched out that snail-like structure and stretched it out, then you get this apex that's over here, right? And there's different sound that is actually detected because of the movement of that membrane. So here at the base is really high frequency, and way up at the end over here is actually low frequency. And the structure of the membrane in there starts off at a very narrow, and then it gets wider and wider as it goes around that snail. And then that detects the movement of that fluid, so you hear high frequency versus low frequency, right? Sounds. So it's really quite neat. if you hear somebody, maybe you've done it, a hearing test, right? They put the headphones on and go beep, you know, left ear, right ear, and they go through the different frequencies, and then all of a sudden, you know, they look at you big like, oh yeah, well you should have heard that, you know, but you're missing it, and so you wonder what happened there. And so they do know, like people that work around construction workers, like jackhammers, that they could actually lose hearing in a particular frequency. Or shotgun sounds, if you're shooting shells all the time, you should wear hearing muffs because you can actually lose your hearing in that particular sound frequency. And how this happens, they've actually done post-mortem exams, and they've done this on mice models too, where they give them sounds, but actually on people too. And they can look at the hair-like structures in this tectorial membrane, and they know that region is for that frequency, right? And they look at it carefully, and remember the kinocilum and the stereocilia we talked about, those little bridges? Those bridges are broken. And so that defect, that causes a defect in how that hair cell moves towards the kinocilum or away from it, because those little bridges are broken, and the bridges don't repair themselves. So once those bridges are damaged, that's it, right? And now you've lost that hearing throughout. And so it's kind of interesting. And they've done these models and rodents and everything else. So really neat when people lose their hearing in that area from whatever the sound might be. Earbuds in your ear with loud rock music. I think that was a big thing a while back. A lot of kids lost their hearing at certain frequencies because they were playing it too loud right into their ear. But at the same time, it's kind of interesting. They did a lot of nice studies with violinists. You know, right next to your ear. So why aren't they losing their hearing with that loud sound right there? And maybe always on the left ear, or, you know, whatever ear they're playing next to. And there's something unusual that they haven't really lost their hearing in that area. And some people are thinking that might be that efferent response back on the hair cells. Does it dampen it somehow? It's still a mystery. I mean, so these are really interesting aspects to try to think about hearing and how does this work and why is it they haven't lost their hearing in that sound so the violins can still play for the long time in their life, right? They didn't just play it in high school and then lose their hearing. So many fascinating aspects in this just to try to get you going. Is that good? Okay. Then you think about other sensory, and like I said, we're jumping quite a bit. We did a little bit of chemo sensory, right, with our hot tamales that we did in the lab, and taste, and remember about 80% of what we think we taste, we really smell, probably. And there's a really good researcher here, Tim McClintock, over in the physiology. He actually used to work with lobsters. Undergraduates liked working with him because he got lots of lobsters, and all he did was their little antennules in the front to work with. And the whole rest of the lobster was like extra. So undergraduates got a lot of lobsters to go cook at home. So it's really quite neat. The lobster, if you look at the crayfish too, it's the same idea. There's this big antenna. They're like the blind person with the walking stick, right? They actually feel what's going around them. And if you could put them with an infrared light on them where they can't sense it, and you put them in a tub, and you put a rock in front of them, they're walking with their big antenna. They hit the rock. They stop, they kind of feel it, and they can walk right over things, right? But the little antennules that are in the front, there's two pairs of them. Those little ones, they will wave back and forth. If you put amino acids in them, they'll start flicking more and more. So it's really quite neat. They'll keep going. They're sensing things. Some of those are little hairs that actually pick the vibration. On those big antennae, too, those are vibration sensitive, right? If they sat out in the water, and some kind of wave was going in the water, an insect fell in, for example, and they see that vibration, they know, oh, hey, maybe I got food out there. But if it's a big vibration, maybe it's a fish or an enemy or something, a predator, right? Got to watch out. The little antennules have little tiny hairs so they can pick up the higher frequency. But next to those little hairs are chemosensory hairs. You can open up the antennule, and you can actually poke the cell bodies, and you can give odorants to a single hair and try to understand how that hair is functioning. What odorants does it detect? To try to understand how do we detect the odorants, right? How do our chemosensory help hair cells work? Not only that, does one neuron detect multiple types of chemosensory input? Or does one neuron only detect one odorant? Or could it have multiple odorants? If it had multiple odorants it could detect, then how does it get a specificity? How does it know one from the other, right? So that's the kind of questions that Tim McClintock has been interested in for many years. Then he went over into mammalian systems, and the reason is because they found out some of the first indications of Alzheimer's is what? Losing your sense of smell. And he wanted to understand if you could use it as an assay to begin to detect you're, you know, going to have Alzheimer's in such a period of time, or is that an early detection method? So it's really quite interesting. Test grandma and grandpa when you go home for the spring break or whatever, and see if they have a really good sense of smell. Because it might be setting up something that you, that families can prepare for too. So it's very interesting looking at that at multiple aspects and understanding that mechanism of action. What are these chemoreceptor hairs and how do they function, for example? And different regions about where they project to in the brain. And think about it. Odorants can cause an autonomic response, right? An odorant that you don't like, that's nauseous, whoa, you know, you want to get away from it really quickly, right? So think of that whole response just by the odorant. And then an odorant that you might like changes your mood. It can actually change your mood, right? It can change you to be fearful and have an autonomic response, cortisol to be released, it changes your glucose levels in your body, right? That's amazing. Or maybe something that's a pleasurable smell, right? And then that changes your whole behavior. And then there's such smells that can, like when you're sick, for example, and you, let's say you're really sick, you had a bad flu bug, and you're just vomiting, you got some kind of poisoning or something, who knows what. And that smell that you happen to have, good examples like eggplant, I hate this smell. But anyways, so if you smelled that, and it would bring back that memory of when you were sick, and you could actually get sick from it, like a psychological problem. So association is really strong with smell. And it's really quite amazing. It can have a big effect on how people function as well, too. Right? Isn't that cool? I mean, I just find that so cool. Sensory is so cool. It can change your whole body and your whole response. Not only that, your endocrine response, glucose levels in your blood, heart rate. Wow. Everything. Really cool. So if anybody ever do this kind of test when you were in middle school or high school, and you do the little thing with the Q-tips, right? Isn't that fun? Was it fun? What did you do?
Okay.
You take the little Q-tips, and you can put sugar or like vinegar, and you can go across the tip of your tongue, right? And you can find out where you're the most sensitive to like vinegar or sugar, and you can actually map out your tongue, and you can put a little dye on that doesn't, it's not toxic to you, hopefully. And you can actually look at the tongue and you can see your little taste buds and you can see where they are. And high school science projects or middle school science projects, you always see one student doing that somewhere. And it's pretty neat. And they go around and test their parents and their kids and siblings and torture everybody around them in their school. But they do that to try to map that out and see what's happening. So it's kind of neat. Anybody ever do that taste test with the little paper that tells your genetics? You know? That you can, and I forget exactly which compound, phenylphthalein or something like that, they put it on their tongue, and some people can taste it, and others can't, and then you can do the parents, and you can check them, and you can find the genetic linkage of your Lyme, because it's a genetic trait, and then you might find out something else that you never knew about before. So I quit doing that in schools, because that was kind of interesting, but I didn't want to get into that problems anymore. So the taste is really quite interesting. Our primary taste that we have, salty, sour, sweet, bitter, and umami. When I was a student, I never heard of that, and it came out where they actually found that, and that's kind of neat too. Glutamate sense, really quite interesting. Do you ever eat Chinese food and see the aspect on the window that says no MSG, right? You know what MSG is? Monosodium glutamate. They usually use it as seasoning, and particularly like in Chinese food or Asian food, and sometimes people have a big reaction to that. Not only does it taste good, you know, it kind of adds flavor to it because of activating these taste receptors, but some people have a strong kind of response to it. And they've now found out that some of this MSG can give you headaches and muscle aches, and people didn't understand that for a long time, and there's probably still people out there that go out and eat, and that evening, they're feeling horrible, and even the next day, like they have a flu, and they don't know why. And then they go to the doc and say, no, you don't have a flu, but they never took a good case history of what did you eat yesterday or something, and then get that relationship. So monosodium glutamate can actually cause cause you to feel like you really have a flu. Your muscles are sore, your neck's sore, you get headaches. Some people get migraines from that. And, you know, that's really quite interesting, too. Some people, actually, they found out that if they have that kind of reaction to monosodium glutamate, you can do something that's really interesting. It's called a whelp test. Rub on their skin, and their skin will whelp up. They've actually, it's called dermographism. You could actually go to the back of the person and write, like, UK on it, and that will whelp up on UK. Kind of cool, right? So you could actually do that to people. But it's interesting. Why are they so sensitive to that? Who knows, right? And it's that whelp test that's kind of interesting as well. And that's a whole interesting aspect. So sometimes dermatologists will pick that up and then realize, hey, are you sensitive to monosodium glutamate? Do you have some other responses? Sometimes if people have some other types of issues, they can have a very sensitive skin. Just by rubbing on it, their skin whelps up like that. You can actually write your name on them. So that's kind of neat to think about. All right. And so let's look at some of these little differences. It's like on your tongue, for example, think of these different receptors that are there. And they function differently. So it gives that specificity about what you might be tasting and how you detect that mechanistically. So I know this figure is a little bit weird because it's got like all on one cell. But you could think of different cells having different ones of these. So some will respond to salt and allow actually sodium to go in. Some of them might let hydrogen to go in, protons, right? That they can detect an acidic environment. And then others might bind to that and then turn on second messenger systems. So there's really a complex process with the chemosensory system. The take home here is that there's different receptors. They function differently. Some are ion channels. Some will allow the ions to go through like a sodium or a proton. Some cases, it might actually block the channel from functioning. Other channels or proteins can work in the second messenger system and then cause the cell excitation or inhibition. So it's interesting. Lots of different processes for understanding chemosensation and taste. If we get to the nose, which is an amazing system, right? Smelling. And when I was a student, like your age, and this was one of the systems that was studied so heavily because these cells in our nose are turnover. And there's a high turnover rate. And you might wonder, why is there a high turnover rate of these cells? Well, damaging aspects, right? Maybe odorants that you smell that could damage that cell. But think, you know, like all we talked about, proteins turnover, right? And every protein in your body has a turnover rate. Well, here it's not just the turnover rate of the proteins, but the whole cell turns over. So there's stem cells in here. And what are these? These are neurons, right? These are sensory neurons. So now we're talking about, wow. At that time, when I was, like, you sitting in there, it was like, wow, these are neurons that turn over, and there's stem cells there, and can make new ones that function. And not only that, they can grow and make synapses onto a second-order neuron. And now we have an adult that has stem cells, new neurons being born. Well, why is it just to the olfactory system? And that was really amazing. So people studied, a lot of research went into the olfaction in various mammals to understand where do stem cells come from and how do the stem cells turn into neurons and how do they project the right interneuron and make the right communication, and they're finding the right target to do that. If we could understand that, can we take those stem cells and put them in someone's brain somewhere else? Will they turn into that type of neuron and make the right connections? So this is the kind of research that was going on for many years to try to understand these stem cells that could turn into neurons and form functional connections in the olfactory circuit. So just to kind of understand that, that was a really interesting history, too, in science. But that these are chemosensory, right? But there's this mucus layer, so you think about what can you smell? These sensory endings just can't be out in the air. They'll dry up and they won't work anymore. So here's a mucus layer. So the odorants have to go through the mucus layer to get to the sensory ending and then work on those receptors, right? It's not just magic going into the cell, but they have to bind to a receptor and cause a response. But that mucus layer is a barrier also, right? And so smelling, relating to that mucus barrier, can vary depending on if you have dried out that mucus or maybe more mucus. When you get a cold, things don't smell not just because you can't smell, but you can't get through that maybe all that mucus that's around there as well. So it's really quite interesting. So there's just a lot of kind of extra information here, but think about this cortex in mammalian brain, 20,000 different scents from only about 1,000 or so different receptor proteins. It's that combination of activating those different cells with multiple receptors on. So it really gives you quite a variety of abilities to smell many different scents. So the anatomy that we want to know about are that these olfactory receptors, they've got little cilia there, like little fingers, that can detect these. Here's like stem cells coming into line that are going to, you know, take away the old ones and new ones are going to form. And then they're going to go to these glomerular tuft where they communicate with the mitral cells. And then these mitral cells make up the olfactory nerve that goes into the brain. On those brains that we showed the other day in the lab, the outreach center, the olfactory lobes were not there, but usually you can kind of just pick those up off the brain, the two of them, one for each side, and pick them up and lay them back down, but they got taken off over the years of use. But it's pretty neat. You can see this, and it goes right by that optic, right towards the front of the optic chiasm. Pretty neat. And then you think about, where do these project to in the brain? There's some aspects where they actually project to a different part in the brain. I don't want to go into the details. I mean, that you can go through a lot of it, but it's really interesting because these different regions in the brain cause different responses. Some just to detect the odorant. Others give a different type of response. And when they've looked at these with animals like dogs and other animals, rodents, they know this particular area that it goes to called the vermonasal region in your brain is mostly for pheromones, to detect pheromones. So if you go out and walk your dog, you know, they go to every bush when you're trying to walk them in a hurry. They go into every bush, smelling every bush, and come on, come on. You know, but they're out for their walk. They love that, you know, walk. They're smelling the urine of all the other, you know, dogs in the neighborhood, and they're peeing on the same spots, all that kind of stuff. Or you've probably seen movies with wolves and other animals where they mark their territory right, and they can actually detect that. But also they can detect a mate that might be an estrus, for example. So it's really quite interesting, these pheromones, and how do they function. Well, we have that part in our brain too, but it's not as prominent as you might see in like a dog or a rodent. But the real key is, and people are still trying to understand it, if you look at, and a lot of colleges have done these studies, and so it's now well established, if you look at dorms and people living in dorms, females will start their cycle, their estrous cycle, and start to synchronize. And they're wondering, why is that synchronization happening? And they think it has to do with the pheromones that actually cause that synchronization. But people don't completely understand that. You might have heard of these stories where people have actually taken athletes that are sweating, and they take that sweat, and then they have blindfold tests, and they, you know, give it to different people. Can you smell something different? Is that, you know, attractive? Is it repugnant? What is that? To try to find out if there's pheromones that might be in the sweat, too, of people. And that kind of went away. There were some really bad social studies that were done with people in England and Europe, and now that's all been debunked pretty much. They were looking at soccer tournaments. You know, soccer's really big in Europe. And wondering why all these people are fighting all the time here, and these other people weren't fighting so much in these soccer matches. So this started a whole weird aspect of social sciences. And so the people that are in the stands that had seats, you know, paid money for it, they weren't fighting as much as all the people that were sitting on the grass, you know, kind of the cheaper seats. And they were wondering, why do they fight so much? And, you know, some social workers came up with, well, they're drinking beer and all that, and some of them just pee on the grass, and maybe it's all those pheromones and testosterone. So they recognized that that might be the problem, and that really wasn't it. It's probably that they're drinking a lot more and all that stuff. But they went through all these studies, and they found out that really didn't cause the aggressive behavior. That probably had other aspects to do with it. But there was that out there for a good while that people thought that had a key to it. But they have done lots of these tests with urine and then isolating different compounds in the urine and seeing if that caused behavioral responses. So still in the humans, this is still something that's being studied. And there's lots of papers out there on this aspect to try to find the volatile compounds that might be a pheromonal response. And you can imagine the perfume industry is interested in that as well, right? Okay, so I know. It's like an epileptic seizure. We're jumping. Keep jumping. Now we're into the visual system. And the visual system is so cool, but there's too much to really try to memorize everything in this field. The general, big picture, simple eyes to more complex eyes. And really, a really complex eye is our eye, the vertebrate retina. But we'll look at something else that's quite interesting as well. So just think of an eye spot, something that can detect light on, off, right? Or the intensity of light. That would, you know, be pretty neat to just have that. Then you think about eyes that develop to detect images, right? Maybe just, maybe even something moving in your visual field. And then maybe the outline of that image. And is it coming towards you or away from you, like a predator, right? Or something. And then you think about understanding more of that visual field, like the flower, or the color of the flower, or what is it that we need to detect? Are changing the light intensity from morning to the afternoon, you don't want the same light in there and saturating those receptors. So just the big picture to think about, oh, that's pretty neat. So if you go across the animal kingdom, you see that whole gradation of different types of eyes in detecting light and imaging. So it's really quite interesting. So that's the main point here. You don't have to memorize all these different types and names here, but the idea of simple eyes to more complex eyes. And the idea is you can think of eye spots that can detect light on, light off, and very simple, like paleanthemanthes, you know, worms, like a round worm or a flat worm, and echinoderms, like your starfish and things. And then more complex animals. Cephalopods are really quite cool. We talked about the squid eye, remember, in the lab, that the nerve, the optic nerve, forms out the back of the retina so they don't have that blind spot. Pretty neat. So that's quite neat. And these compound eyes, which insects and crustaceans have, pretty neat. And so we'll talk a little bit more about compound eyes as well. So the idea is, you know, simple eyes to more complex eyes, and then how to process the information in the brain. And that's pretty cool, too. One of these master animals is this mantis shrimp. People started working on the mantis shrimp, and they just, like, blown away. Here's a simple invertebrate that has an ability to see spectrum that we can't detect. And their eyes are so good. And you're just like, why can't we do something like that? That is so neat. And these animals are masters. So let's look at something with these mantis shrimp eyes. Look at all the little eye parts to this, you know, stub that's sticking out of the animal's head where all the visual input's coming in. Amazing. They got all these little spots where they can detect light. But not only that, that whole eye stalk can rotate. So they can rotate this around and move their eye and move their head. And that gives them different polarized light. It's like wearing sunglasses, right? You can see better when you have the sunglasses on a sunny day. You can see someone walking in front of you. Don't hit them, right? But if you turn the sunglasses sideways, it's a little bit different than having them straight on. Try that sometime. It's really cool. Well, that's what they found out these mantis shrimp are doing, and it's really neat. So let's go over here to this really fun thing. Somewhere I have it. There's our endolymph stuff. Okay, mantis shrimp. So cool. I think the volume's up. Where's our volume? Mute, unmute. I'm not getting any volume. Horrible. Well, I hear it. Here we go.
In their powerful predatory attack strike, as well as for their spectacularly complex visual systems.
And they're so colorful. That's a key element as well, right? Because detecting the colors for the mate and things like
that. Their large eyes scan the environment independently and possess an array of 12 types of photoreceptors that provide the mantis shrimp with complex color reception. For comparison, in humans, only 3 receptor types are involved in color vision.
We're pathetic.
The compound eyes of the mantis shrimp are composed of an array of facets with dorsal and ventral peripheral regions bisected horizontally by 6 parallel rows of large specialized facets called the midband. Photoreceptors in the midband encompass the majority of spectral diversity in the eye. each facet, light passes through optical components before entering a series of tiered photoreceptors making up the retina. In the mantis shrimp species, Neocondylus forstii, the most distal photoreceptors in the retina have been shown by electrophysiology to be sensitive to at least 5 discrete wavelength ranges of ultraviolet light, making this the most complex ultraviolet photoreceptor array known in nature. This spectral diversity suggests the presence of several visual pigments, the molecules that absorb light and transduce visual signals, with differing wavelengths of maximum absorbance in the ultraviolet range. However, molecular analysis found only 2 opsins, the protein components of visual pigments, expressed in the retina. These opsins form visual pigments that absorb ultraviolet light maximally around only 2 wavelength ranges. Surprisingly, 5 of the 6 ultraviolet receptor types contain the exact same visual pigment, meaning that the ultraviolet photoreceptor sensitivities are tuned by some other means. We hypothesized that this tuning could be achieved by ultraviolet color filters, invisible to us and positioned in the optical path of certain facets of the midband. Luckily, we were able to visualize these filters by their weak ultraviolet-stimulated autofluorescence, and we localized them to the optical components that overlie the photoreceptors in the optical path of certain midband rows. These filters block specific wavelength ranges of ultraviolet light from reaching their associated photoreceptors, thus diversifying their spectral sensitivities to produce the full diversity that was observed with electrophysiology. The identity of these ultraviolet filter pigments also came as a surprise. We found the filters to be composed of various microsporin-like amino acids. Microsporins are commonly referred to as nature's sunscreens and are usually employed for UV photoprotection in a variety of primarily aquatic animals. However, mantis shrimp uniquely incorporate them into powerful spectral tuning filters, extending and diversifying their preeminently elaborate photoreceptive arsenal.
Is that not cool? That is so cool. That is so cool. I think that thing might start up again if I'm not careful. Let's get rid of that thing. Okay. So, pretty neat to think about mantis shrimp and what they can do versus what we can do, right? So really amazing eye in a simple invertebrate animal. But by that research, understanding it and rotating it, they realize that polarization is changing as well as the structures inside those bands. Amazing. Okay, so then we get kind of the vertebrate eye, and there's a lot in the text, if you're reading the textbook, and there's a lot in the PowerPoints too. I don't want you to know everything about this, because it's just way too much stuff. But the main points. Light comes in. You have this ability to change the iris, open and close it, like a camera, right? It's like a diaphragm on a camera. It can open a shutter, basically, that can lower it down or raise it up to get more light or less light in. So that's part of it. And then you have the lens. And this lens is really amazing because it can focus the image that you're seeing out in your visual field onto the back of the retina. But that lens, think about it, if you had just held a lens and you were looking at a microscope, you know, only something's in focus, right, where that lens, where you're seeing it. But then how can you see farther away or close up? That lens actually can change its shape. It can, the muscles pull on the lens and actually change the shape of the lens. And that's how you focus far away or closer up. It's amazing. Your lens changes. The older you get, that becomes more rigid, for example, and it doesn't work so well. So then you have to start to wear glasses. All right. So this is really amazing that this lens can change its shape by pulling on these ligaments or these muscles that pull on it. And it can happen very fast, right? You can look up close, you can look far away, and you can change very quickly to understand that. Not only that, but where that projects to, right? Where that projects onto the back of your retina and what makes up this back of the retina. Now, we found the blind spot right here, right, in the lab the other day, because wherever that visual field was projecting right here, we have no sensory neurons. In that region, that's where the optic nerves exiting the back of the retina. But we look at this region right in here, and the fovea is a spot where you generally try to focus. When you look at something, that image is trying to project it right onto the fovea. In that region is where you have the highest acuity to see something, right? The highest acuity. And we'll talk a little bit about that later on. But in the fovea, you have mostly, here's these two types of sensory cells in there that we're going to talk about, rods and cones. They're given the name cones because they look like a cone shape, and the rods because they look like a rod. You have a high density of cones in the fovea region. And those cones, remember this, cones for color. See, cones, color, okay? I know it's corny, but you won't forget it now, because you might see that again. So cones detect color. So that gives you really good color vision. The rods for black and white, pretty much, sensitivity of just light. So when you're focusing on something, you're going to focus, and that image is primarily going to go right into your fovea, where you're focusing, and if it's a color, you're going to be able to see it really well in those spectrum, like red, blue, and green. Okay, and then the rods are pretty much on the outside. The rods for black and white. Anybody like looking at stars at night, right, when you're daydreaming? Anybody does astronomy or stuff? So when you're looking at the stars, either with your binoculars or a telescope, what they'll tell you is not to look directly at that star that you're trying to look at, because what's going to happen? That white image goes right to your fovea, which is for cones. You want to see it in your rods. So you look off-center from that star that you're looking at, and now the projection will be on your rods, and you can see it much better. And so it's really kind of interesting to think about that anatomy then works with what you're trying to look at, right? And then also like the saturation of the colors and how sensitive you can be. You look at the old war movies, right? And on the ship, on the Navy ship, they say, lights out, right? And they turn on the red lights. Why is that? The red light is harder to see far away than that white light, right? And you can see that close up, and that white light's not giving out that signal far away to, say, an enemy that might be trying to find you. So lots of interesting aspects with the light and light sensitivity. All right, so you got the general idea. Now we're going to get down into some of the nitty-gritties of that retina. So the main point here is to understand that there are muscles that control, and you don't have to know exactly which ones, but to control the diaphragm so it, you know, detects either more light coming, allows more light in or less light in, and then muscles that can change the lens. Memorizing all the different names, I'm not interested in that. But also this parasympathetic and sympathetic response too, right? You're fearful. Something's attacking you. What's going to happen? You want to be visually aware, right? So your sympathetic response, you don't have to think about it, will change how you perceive that image in front of you and how you'll be sensitive to it. Parasympathetic lets you kind of dilate and your eyes will become, the iris opens up and you can have more of the black spot that's on there too. And that's actually something that's socially interesting as well. And we'll talk about that when we get to the sympathetic parasympathetic system a little bit more. All right. So that's kind of interesting to think about. All right. You might probably, you know, as we're off to it, belladonna, for example, and the idea, and that you see this in all the textbooks, the ancient Egyptians, you know, would put belladonna like in the eye or something like this that causes dilation so they would see more of the black part of the eye. And that was more of a receptivity, more sexually attractive, if you will, that more of a relaxed state, parasympathetic state. So that could give a cue for people. And the same with other animals, for example. All right. So we've talked about lens changing its shape, curvature of the lens. I'm just kind of getting through this. If you want more information on it, you can look at this. But the parasympathetic and sympathetic response also for the opening up and seeing more of the black around your eye. All right. We've talked about these pretty much already. But here's the gist that we wanted to get to. So rods and cones that we mentioned, you see a mixture here. Cones and rods. Cones for color. What's the take-home here? Is when light has to go through these layers. So your lens is over here. So the light's coming through. And in our eyes, light is penetrating through these layers of neurons, right? Through these layers of neurons, and then finally, in the back of these layers, it's activating these sensory cells, these rods and cones. And so light's being absorbed in here and causing these to change their electrical activity. And then you have this pigment layer in the back. What does the pigment layer in the back do? Keeps the light from scattering around, so it absorbs the light. So light will come in, and that's it. It's absorbed here. People that have a melatonin issue. Albinos, for example, they might not develop this area, and so they're very sensitive to the light because that light's scattering in their eyes. So if you see an albino, for example, they're out in the sunny day, they're probably wearing sunglasses because that light is very sensitive to them. All right. So that's kind of interesting to think about, too, in this whole anatomy. So light's coming in here, hitting these cells, and it somehow that light has to activate the cell or inactivate the cell, right? So how is it that we perceive that light, that photon of light, and then the different colors as well? While we're on this picture, it's kind of interesting. These cells, in the dark, they're releasing transmitter. Vesicles are fusing right here, in the dark, okay? General take-home. In the dark, they're active. In the dark. But when light hits it, it actually stops the vesicles from fusing. So it becomes inactive. It actually inhibits the cell. Isn't that wild? It inhibits the cell. So now it's not releasing transmitter anymore. That's just wild, isn't it? Because everything that we think about, light, whatever the sensory stimulus, should be exciting it, but it actually inhibits these cells. So there's less transmitter release. They go to the bipolar cell, and they call that because of the bipolar nature. And that bipolar cell goes to a ganglion cell, and that ganglion cells leave the retina, and that make up the optic nerve. So these ganglion cells have very long axons. They're going into the brain and making up that optic nerve, which is about 1 million neurons in each optic nerve. That's a lot of neurons, right, coming out of your retina. These other cells, called the horizontal cell because they go horizontal, and the endocrine cells are kind of like the horizontal cells, and they go back between these cells. This is where we get, somebody had the question in the lab about the lateral inhibition, for example, right? And then can cause other cells to change their activity over here to give that acuity where you're seeing that image. There are people that spend their whole lifetime just understanding this complexity and how these neighboring cells can be inhibited and how this whole process works, because this is like a little brain right here. And people build computer programs just to try to understand this process in the back of the retina because it's so complex. And there's more being discovered all the time. What's really quite neat is the fish, their eye can continue to grow. Our eyes don't continue to grow. Their eyes continue to grow. And they can add in new rods as they're growing, and the eye gets bigger. And now think about that. That means new neurons that have to project to new, you know, horizontal cells and endocrine cells, and then they have to leave the eye and the ganglion cells and then project into the brain. How are they doing that? How is that happening in an adult animal that's continuing to grow and the eye's getting bigger and new neuronal connections? Phenomenal. So this is why people study fisheye development, to try to understand the pathfinding and how all this process is working. So for our purposes, we have to know the vertebrate eye is this kind of structure. Light comes in, activates these cells, and then the activity goes back out. But it's really a decrease in activity of the rods and cones with light. And then through the horizontal cells and amacrine cells, that can give your lateral inhibition and actually give you very good edge contrast to whatever you're looking at. So the take home here is, gives you really good edge contrast, it gives you this ability to focus on that object, and that, you know, cones are in the fovea, highest acuity, rods in the periphery, and then we have different kinds of cones for the different colors, and as shown here, green, red, and blue. So that's where it will absorb that light and then change the activity. Okay, so let's go through some of that. That's really quite cool. So here's our rods and cones, and light will come in here and hit these little layers, if you will, these little discs, they call them. And then in those discs, you have a protein that's in there, an opsin. And retinol that's inside of there will absorb that light depending on the type of opsin that we have, either ones that detect the red, the blue, the green, or white light, or not. And then there's actually this retinol that's in there that is in the cis structure, but when light hits it, it actually changes to this transform, and then it can cause this protein to change its conformation and change the activity of the cell. So think about the energy. So a lot of mitochondria in here, right? A lot of mitochondria. And now let's go to what happens. And I think really this figure, it's a little bit hard to see in the background, but you can kind of go through this. But let's go through it a little bit. So in the dark, there's no light, right? And then there's this high concentration of cyclic GMP that's in there. So actually this cell stays in a hyperpolarized... No, this sodium channels are open, so it stays in a depolarized state. And then this depolarization of the photoreceptor, because sodium's coming in all the time. But when we change over here to light, light will actually decrease the cyclic GMP, and then it closes the sodium channels. So think about sodium rushing in the dark. What's that going to do? It's going to keep it depolarized. But that depolarization of the sodium channel happens because of cyclic GMP. If we're depolarized, and now we stop the sodium from coming in, what does the cell want to do? It wants to go down, right? So it's going to hyperpolarize with light. So it's just the opposite of what we might think in the sense of activity, light. It will hyperpolarize with the stimulus. And what that does, that decreases the amount of transmitter that's going to be released. So it's really quite interesting in that process. So do look at this in the PowerPoint and understand this general idea of sodium influx. Here's a take home: sodium influx in the dark. And that is called the dark current, right? Darth Vader. The dark current, right? Because of, in the dark, these channels are open. So sodium's rushing into it, keeps it depolarized. In the light, it closes these sodium channels, and then it will hyperpolarize and decrease the amount of transmitter release. So then there's less activity onto the bipolar cells, and then that sets up this process of understanding which cells are active. There's a lot into this little figure, but what we just went through was the main take-home of that, okay? And let's see, if I think there's a nice little figure here. I used to have a nice little figure. Okay. Well, it's not there anymore. So the idea is that it's through cyclic GMP that keeps these cells, these sodium channels open, okay? So that's the main point. All right, so we went through that, basically. I know there's a lot to there, but I'm not trying to make you crazy. I'm trying to keep you the main take-home points here. And then about the different types of opsins for the three different colors, all right? And you might hear people that are colorblind. Do they still do that on the driving test, where they give you that little, like, six? You can see the letters, the numbers.
A certain age,
okay. And basically, they want to do the color test, and they give you little dots, and they see, can you see the number, you know, or something in the figure? And they used to do that. Why would they used to do that? Why would it matter, do you think?
Traffic lights.
But they realized that was kind of silly. Big waste of money, right? Because all the traffic lights, red, yellow, green.
My brother's colorblind, and when it's dark out, you can't tell the difference between the flashing red and the flashing yellow.
That could be it.
You've
got to slow down. So the flashing lights might be the thing to do. But, you know,
I know when it's dark, you can't really see.
Well, but the other colors, you know, like, you know the order that's going to happen, right? That's kind of odd. But flashing lights, that's a good one. So maybe they want to keep that going. So anyways, like you saw in the manna shrimp, we're kind of pathetic compared to them. And we don't see in the UV light, right? We only see in this spectrum. The visible, which we call visible, is visible to us, so we've defined it that way, right? All right, so that's about it with that. And if we talk about the visual pathways, I don't want you to have to memorize a whole bunch of all this information. It's really neat. The whole visual pathways are so cool that it's very interesting. And you look at it in different animals, it's really interesting. The take home here is you have visual fields. Think about your two retinas, and they're in front of us, right? So the light that comes through the lens from our left side, let's say, is projected over here on the right side of our retinas, right? And over on the right is projected over in our left. So if they just went straight back, that might be a little confusing for the brain in a sense. So what happens is you have this optic chiasm that actually allows the whole left visual field to go to one side and the whole right visual field to go to the other side. And that's pretty cool, Isn't that pretty cool? So it corrects that before it goes on to the next order of neurons inside the brain. And so those optic chiasm is to keep the visual fields in line for the processing. Here's the next thing to remember, is that they project, the optic nerve projects to the lateral geniculate nucleus. That lateral geniculate nucleus then projects to the back in the visual cortex, in the back of your brain, back here. So if you hit your head, for example, and you bruise it in the back, like your brain's back and forth, and you bruise the back, the doc would ask you, if you have any visual impairments in the next couple days, let me know, because maybe you busted some blood vessels back here or on your brain, or you maybe caused some swelling back here in the brain, and you're going to have a visual problem. So that's why they ask you if you have a visual problem. Or did you detach your retina, for example, with hitting your head against the wall? All right, so this is part of it. What's really interesting here, and this is the point I want to make, you see these pathways coming from the other eye and the pathways coming from this eye? So these have different layers. They're called layers, like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. I don't want you to have to memorize which layers come from the right eye or the left eye, but I want you to realize that there's different layers for the two different eyes that are coming in. And they're competing for that space, that synaptic space. This is really interesting because this won a Nobel Prize. Not just because of that, but it's the development of your visual field and the fundamental principles in neuroscience. So here comes this activity going on to this as you develop and you get your visual field and focus on objects. So the right eye is kind of competing for synaptic spaces over here, and so the left eye is competing over here too. But what happens if this eye doesn't function? Or maybe like we talked about that wandering eye to the side. Then what happens in development? If this one's not firing at the same time this one's firing, guess what? This one will take over that visual space. And let's say we correct that eye, and this is why we went into that point about the correction of the wandering eye early on. Then this is set. If it goes past a critical period, the critical period is meant when the nervous system doesn't show the changes anymore. So now this is set. And so even if you correct it and this is trying to compete for it, it can't gain that space back again. This is why when they were doing these research work, Ubel and Wiesel, that were students of Stephen Kuffler at Harvard that worked out presynaptic inhibition and all that stuff we talked about in the crayfish, he actually gave this project onto Ubel and Wiesel. They followed this up in kittens and in primates and monkeys, and some really horrendous experiments that were done for them. They could actually take the monkey, open up the mother, work with the fetal monkey, close the eye up so it wouldn't see when it was born, for example, or actually do surgery on it, put it back, you know, allow it back in the monkey so they could understand these visual processes. But not only that, to understand the visual cortex and how it develops so you could look at defects in humans and understand how humans function. So, yes, they had to use primates, but it helped understand how we function in our disorders. And then they did this in kittens as well, because, you know, kittens are born with their eyes closed, right? The eyelids are closed. Well, they would actually keep them closed, and they would look at visual development, and they would understand that plastic period, and they understood the critical period in neural development where the synapses are made. And if you correct those problems before the critical period, the connections would be right. So it changed the way ophthalmologists would do surgeries on people with wandering eyes. They would shorten these muscles up earlier or lengthen them so they could actually get their visual field correct and their nervous system would develop correct. From that work, that was pioneer work back in the 60s and 70s, they understood that, oh, critical period in the visual system. What about critical period for hearing? What about critical period for moving your fingers and worrying about proprioception? What about critical period in locomotion? Should we keep the baby still if it has maybe a little defect or something? Or should we let them move around? That changed everything by looking at the primates and kittens. So, yes, animal research, but it changed the whole understanding of how the nervous system works. So, you might have heard of these stories in Romania, Ceausescu, I don't know, maybe there's a generation gap, that he was a really bad dictator. It was a horrible thing on TV that they showed because the public got upset with it. And they shot him and his wife, and they were, like, dead in the street. I still remember that. It was traumatic. Anyway, so they, like, showed it over and over on TV. Well, he had baby farms. And these baby farms, you know, weird things a long time ago. Baby farms, not that long ago, actually. Baby farms, and these babies were raised in these big facilities, but they weren't getting any attention. Well, when some of them died, they saved some of them, and they looked at their brains. The part in the cerebellum that gives you coordination, there's a cell there called the Purkinje cell. It's a big cell with dendrites up here, and these little spines that come off for synaptic connections. Well, they looked at those baby brains, and they found out they didn't have the little spines. And the reason was because they didn't play with things. They didn't have things to touch and play. When they defined that and actually detected that and showed it all, they found the comparative neurobiologist said, hey, that's nothing new. We knew that in monkeys a long time ago, right? So they did the same kind of studies. But now it was shown that it does happen in humans. So this is why if you have kids, you want to give them mobile things to play with. You want to give them various sounds. You want them to locomote because those all have critical periods in development of the nervous system. Okay, sorry, I went on. If you're in ecology next, good luck on your exams.